If you're looking for the skills and tools to succeed in real estate investing, you've come to the right place. This show is about breaking through barriers, breaking through limiting beliefs, and breaking through to the life that you want to live through the power of real estate investing. You're listening to the Breakthrough Real Estate Investing Podcast. And now, here are your hosts, Rob Brake and Quentin D'Souza.
Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for joining us again today. As usual, Quentin D'Souza is here with me. Quentin, how are you?
Hey, good. How about yourself?
I am awesome. I am doing really, really well today. Feel like a million bucks. I don't look like a million bucks, but I feel like a million bucks.
Oh, that's good. I feel really good too. I just came back from a workout, and I'm heading to Iceland next week to do a 10-day trip up, mountainscapes and through some glaciers and, you know, some volcanic areas. So it should be a lot of fun. So I'm looking forward to that. Yeah.
That sounds really cool. Yeah. But, you know, but for those of you who don't know, Quentin, the only work Quentin does anymore is this. That's it. He's off doing what is it? Forest bathing and and all this hiking and exploring that you're doing.
Yeah, no, I mean, certainly, you know, I've got 580 some odd units. It keeps me pretty busy, I gotta say, but I've structured my, you know, the way that I do things with the employees that I have and the partners that I have and all that makes it a lot easier for me to be able to, do these other things, right?
Right.
I'm certainly busy for sure.
And you couldn't do that stuff. You couldn't manage that many units alone.
No, definitely not.
For those of you who haven't done so, please go over to breakthroughreipodcast.ca. Listen to all of our past shows, get in contact with our past guests. Maybe for lucky hookup, I don't know.
Hey man, hookup means something different to this generation as opposed to.
Yeah, and I guess that's why I'm like, keep saying it like that. Okay. But anyway, you know, get in contact with our past guests and all that info is over there at breakthroughreipodcast.ca. And then if you haven't done so, go over to iTunes and leave a rating or review. I got a review to read here right now. Quentin's on top of this stuff. He sent me this. Someone just left a review. 5 stars. No surprise, really, but 5 stars. It says, fantastic podcast. Great hosts. Great guests. Great information. Highly recommend this podcast for any aspiring or experienced real estate investors. That was by Jordan Walsiak.
Thanks, Jordan. We appreciate everybody who leaves us a review. Really helps us in our ratings. And, you know, if you find this podcast interesting, please share it with a friend, because the only way to get this out there is
that we share. Go over and leave us a rating and review, please.
Yep. All right. I wanted to bring up something.
Absolutely. Can you still hear me? Am I still there?
Yes. We still hear you for sure.
It's glitching on my end, so I just wasn't sure. You had a couple of things. What's going on with you, Quentin? What's new? Tell us some stuff.
Well, I've been warning people about promissory notes for the last few episodes and over the years, but another investor, Daniel St. John, is being investigated by the Ontario Securities Commission. He is a realtor, but also a real estate investor and runs a real estate club out in the west end of the GTA. And he has raised more than $25 million. This is a Globe and Mail article. More than $25 million in promissory notes from small investors and has stalled projects. I've been getting his emails over the years, actually, and the last time I got an email from him was in July, and he was looking for funds, I believe, for a renovation, and before that, he was looking for funds for projects in, I'm not not sure exactly what country. Maybe it was Costa Rica, but it was all unsecured. So he was looking for funds, but he was going to build or do some development projects in, I believe, on the East Coast and in South America somewhere, or Central America somewhere. And this is exactly what, you know, without any security, all these people are, well, they haven't been paid. And the Ontario Securities Commission is doing that investigation.
I ask you something?
Yeah, go ahead.
How do you kick the can down the road like this so successfully? How does that happen?
Only for so long, right? Because you're borrowing money to pay off.
But he's been doing this for years, right?
Yeah, but there's a certain point where, you know, you have to keep filling the bottom with new promissory notes. And if you can't do that, then eventually you're going to find it. You can't keep up. And, you know, I've heard through other investors, you know, about his business practices. And, you know, I did have him once speak at Durham REI a long time ago, but I haven't since then. And you know, you just never know what's happening with people, right? And what they do, but you get to know, you know, people and their business practices over time, right? Usually you hear the same sort of names come up within, you know, different issues, whether it's like you know, a mortgage broker's name, like Claire Drage. Anyway, she had corporate bankruptcy and personal bankruptcy, and she had raised private mortgages and prom notes for Robbie Clark, for other people who've also had different issues. Not saying that this is, you know, something that she did as well, but it's just the process is the same. So people have to be careful of promissory notes, because they're only as good as the paper that they're written on. And you know, it could
mean, in some cases, right?
Yeah, in some cases, yeah. It could be very problematic.
I can't remember what I was going to ask you. What sparked the investigation?
Complaints from people not being paid. So there were a number of investors that weren't being paid. And, you know, the amount of funds borrowed on different projects are literally in the hundreds. At least that's what it looks like. You know, raised $12 million with 139 promissory notes, 109 investors on $13.5 million on promissory notes. It's a lot of people. So things to watch out for.
Wow.
Yeah. Crazy stuff. And did you hear about Trudeau? The latest?
I'm over here now. So I try to, don't worry. It invades my space. Go on. Let's talk about it.
Well, you know, his housing plan, tends to announce things over and over again every year, it seems, and seems to be something similar. This time, and not that he hasn't announced using federal land for, you know, creating affordable housing. Because if you look back in his previous, you know, things that he's talked about, you know, he's talking about the same thing, and other governments have talked about the same thing as well, except he wants to land lease these houses. Anybody heard of a land lease before? So if you're not aware of land leases, like sometimes in provincial parks, you might get like a land lease where somebody has a cottage on land, and the land is basically, you know, you have it for 100 years, but at the end of that 100 years, anybody else can kind of, or the person that owns it, or the federal government that owns it can take it back. That's exactly what he's proposing. It's almost like getting into the condo business, basically, right? Like but instead the federal government still owns the land. Very interesting. You know, to hear these sort of things come from the Trudeau government, really, like, you know, my opinion, and this is just my opinion, is just let the investors do their job. Stop vilifying investors and let them help to create housing in Canada, right? Because that's what they usually do when they're not hampered by governments that seem to create more bureaucracy and stop that, right? So, you know, that's a healthy...
Well, without knowing too much about this, like on paper, it doesn't sound like such a bad idea, you know, but I'm sure it doesn't pan out the way that, that, you know, in all a positive way.
Well, I mean, they're kind of, I guess,
the idea is affordable housing. So I'm sure that they're like the land lease rate would be probably, you know, a lot less, let's say, than rent, maybe.
Well, who's going to be, is the federal government going to be the developer? Are they going to pay a developer to do this? Like, what is that going to look like? Where's the incentives in these projects anyways? It'll be interesting to actually hear our guests, you know, point of view on this, because this is right up, you know, his alley. But maybe we can do a little bit of an introduction here for our guest. So Luke Wyrett is a professional engineer. He is also a PMP, PMI. He started his first construction project at the age of 14. He left the industry to pursue a career in nuclear and mechanical engineering, and was a project lead at OPG, overseeing projects there. He has a passion for construction and started his life as an entrepreneur in the custom home building space. He used his technical and business know-how and previous work experience to, you know, scale, and that grew into LCH Developments. And he is his company's CEO and COO. He's responsible for real estate development projects, acquisitions, municipal approvals, construction management and operations. And he's a registered builder with Terrien. So without further ado, I know that, there's also the Elevate Construction Management piece and a few other pieces. I wanted to introduce Luke Wyrett.
Thanks for being here.
Yes. Hello. Thank you for having me on. Sounds like you read that off of like some kind of company profile or something.
You know, Luke has been on the show before, but it was over 6 years ago. You know that?
Oh, wow.
So there's a lot has changed since then.
Yeah.
But thanks for coming back.
Yeah, no problem. Glad to be back.
I think I've known you for probably 14 years or something like that.
I think it was during our rain days, and it was 2006, I believe, is when we met.
Wow.
So that's crazy. It's been a while. It's been a while since we've known each other, maybe even earlier.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was at your wedding too. And that was a blast. That was so much fun. All right. Let's go forward and kind of, get a little bit about, maybe you can give us a little bit about your journey to where you, you know, got to today, because you're doing some amazing projects.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll give you a brief history. I started basically right after school. I got a job as an engineer and I started buying real estate. I had some joint venture partners and we started buying in Hamilton at the time, student rentals. We did a rent to own, duplexes, triplexes. Did that for about four years, I would say. Got up to, at a certain point, I owned about 30 rental properties, managing them all myself, still had my full-time job. So it was at that point I decided, you know what, I don't really want to be... first of all, I didn't need to be working a full-time job. And I also didn't want to be buying more rentals. I wanted to focus on something that I'd like to do, which is construction and development. So I went into building custom homes. We built a few custom homes in the Toronto area. After that, we would buy lots, take the lot, split it in two, build two semis or two detached homes. Then we would take a lot, maybe divide it into four. We did a few of those projects. Then we got into bigger projects. So we did a 16-unit townhouse project. There was an interesting one that we did a church conversion. So we took an old church and if we did 14 kind of like luxury boutique units inside of that. We did a few other projects. One other project that we just kind of took to approvals and then we sold it off. So we and then our last project that we started in 2017, we just finished construction on it last August. So it was registered last August and there was 190 units. So 190 homes that people moved into. So we're glad to be done that one. And currently we have four projects that we're working on actively at various stages in the development process.
Wow, it's a lot going on there. That's incredible that it takes that. I mean, I know it's a lot of units and everything, but you said you started in 2017.
2017 is when we started acquiring the sites. That's right. And then we went through approvals. That took us into late 2019. I think 2020 is when we started construction. 2020 started construction. Then that took about just under 3 years.
And you're really land banking at that point, right? Like you're picking up those pieces, but holding on to them and, you know, running through the processes in order to be able to do these larger developments.
Yeah, that's right. You try to buy them either for, and you try to get great terms. That was kind of the way that I've done most of my projects is ahead of time. We know that these things are going to take a few years. So let's do a really long closing or, you know, if we can't do that, let's try to get a really good price from the vendor if we have to close like within 60 days.
So you do like an option is, are you doing options on the land like for 3 years or something like that?
And we have done options before, but usually it's just an extended closing. So like closing 1 year out with an option to extend two times, 6 months each time. So you're buying now and it's got like a two year, basically closing time. You tell the vendor, yeah, you know, if we get approvals quicker, we'll close quicker. But, you know, Toronto being what it is, it being the slowest municipality in all of North America to get approvals.
Wow.
You know, it's not going to happen in a year. It's not going to happen in 2 years. It'll take you at least 3 years.
3 years. So you do end up closing on these properties with these options, even though you're not ready, but you have a good sense of where you're going to go to. I have a feeling by the end of the year too, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Have there been any land parcels you've had to let go?
No. All of them. Usually we have let's say 3 to 6 month due diligence condition when we buy these, when we're buying these properties. So we would meet up with the city, tell them what our plan is. And in, you know, concept wise, they'll be okay with it. Like if they're not okay with it, then actually, you know what? There wasn't one development that we did let go. I forgot about that one. That one was in Stoneville. That was like 5-6 years ago. We had a big lot. We were going to do 6 single family homes. The city wasn't a fan of it. So we the consultant cost, whatever. And we just kind of moved on from that. There's no sense in fighting with the city because then you're going into the Ontario Land Tribunal and municipal lawyers. They are $1,000 an hour, $1,100 an hour.
And so it sounds to me
about
like
about a week that you're in front of the tribunal, maybe 2 weeks.
Whoa.
But the concept approval doesn't take that long. That's a pretty streamlined process. It's not bad.
Uh, Yeah, it's you have some plans. You go in front of the city. You usually urban design is going to be there, maybe engineering, planning department. You're like, okay, this is what we're thinking. And they'll be like, oh, okay, you know what? Yeah, that, you know, more or less that's kind of good, but we want you to change this, that. And you have a good sense. You go back to the drawing board, you make your official submission, and then you wait for comments. And then you're going back and forth. And sometimes you can be dealing with the city. You know, it takes for site plan approval. You'll be on your fourth or fifth resubmission before you finally get your like site plan agreement.
Mm-hmm. How long does that take? Is that like within a year or?
Two and a half years.
So that's just the site plan. Wow.
That's the site plan approval, yeah.
Oh, the site plan approval is what takes the long time.
That's the longest time.
Zoning. So why does it take so? Let's get into this. Why does it take so long? Why is Toronto in this spot that they're in, having that reputation for builders and developers?
The amount of okay, there's a few reasons about the amount of studies that's required. They have been understaffed. So it took them, you know, on some of our applications, it took them 8 months before they were able to send us official comments after our first site plan submission. It took them 8 months to get us comments back because they were just so backlogged. But so that and also they're very, none of the departments talk with each other. And you know, engineering department might want this, planning department might want that, urban design, and then there's urban forestry, and you're trying to figure out all these issues. And it's not like you can say, you know what, everybody, let's get on a call, let's get a, you know, let's set up a meeting, let's hash this out. It doesn't work like that. It's very difficult to get everyone in the same room at the City of Toronto. So then you got to make another submission. And then you wait a month or a couple months and you'll get comments back. Hopefully it's a few less comments. You make another submission. And then at the fourth submission, usually you and the planner, or as long as engineering and the planner is happy, then you're good.
It's so crazy. And then, because we had a guest on from Edmonton and she does infill development. And, you know, she was saying that the like it takes literally 3 months for her to get anything done. Like,
and she was what, eight? Was it 8-unit buildings they were doing?
Yeah, 6 or 8-unit buildings and like over and over again. Right.
Edmonton sounds like a dream. I heard that their development charges are probably some of the lowest in Canada and their timelines are probably some of the fastest. That they're able to turn things over.
Wow. So what are those charges and fees that you face in the GTA, like when you're planning on doing a development?
Those fees. Whenever I look at that number on the pro forma, it makes me cringe. I actually wrote an article about this on LinkedIn about you know, comparing the development charges or the fees that cities charge in all of North America. So I took, you know, New York City, Miami, Chicago, Seattle, LA, San Francisco, Calgary, Montreal, Vancouver, and I believe Ottawa and Toronto. And out of all of those cities, taking into account even the exchange rate between the US Canadian dollar, Toronto had the highest fees in all of North America. Second was Vancouver. Third was San Francisco.
Wow.
New York City, like Seattle, some of these other places, their fees were much lower. So what did I do? I took a 220 unit building, 150,000 square feet. And I calculated what the fees would be in each of those cities. In Toronto, it was $18 million in fees that you'll be paying to the City of Toronto. Vancouver was around 15, 16. And I think San Francisco was above 14, 15. And then other places like, you know, Texas, Austin, Texas, it was about 1 million. Calgary was about 1.5 million. Halifax was 1.5 as well. Montreal was 5 million. You know, so like you got, it's all over the place, but Toronto, Vancouver, highest in all of North America.
And the population sizes, like, it makes no sense, because if you take some of those populations that you have, like you were mentioning, San Francisco and Texas, they have population sizes very similar to what I would say is, you know, Toronto, right?
That's right. Yeah. Oh, and one other thing. In the US, they don't have sales tax on new construction homes. There's no sales tax at all. In Toronto, in all of Canada, I think Alberta, you just pay the federal portion, but we have that HST tax. So that adds another, what is it, about $50,000 a unit to the purchase price.
Wow. So what percentage is like fees and charges that are like governmental, like of a, let's say you're going to buy a unit that costs $500,000, let's say. How much of that $500,000 unit is going to be like fees and charges?
Yeah, so $500,000 unit, that would be about $170,000 is just fees, HST and like City of Toronto fees.
Wow. That's a crazy amount. That's like 35% or...
Yeah, it's wild. That's why housing is like new construction is expensive.
So what keeps you... Okay, this is a little off track. What keeps you in the GTA then? Like why not go to a different market and, you know, it's easier or it's less expensive?
It's a good question. We are looking into it. We are looking into other markets. We started off in this market just because of the strong economic fundamentals. When we started out, the fees weren't as crazy. They're much less, but over the past like 7 years, you know, just in this past May, the City of Toronto increased the fees by 20%.
Wow.
A few years before that, they increased it by another, I think it was 50%. And there's no reason why the fees should be going up that high. They're forcing new condo or new buyers, purchasers, to pay for improvements throughout the city, as opposed that benefits everybody, which, you know, doesn't make sense. And it shouldn't be that way.
Yeah, you would think that it would have to do with property taxes or, like, you know, everybody's paying for everything, not just one segment of the population or one type of, you know, tax ends up paying for a majority of that. It's also, I think it's kind of short-sighted too from a municipal perspective, because, you know, that means that you're always dependent on development. And
that's right.
And if you're driving all the development away, you're forced to have to raise property taxes, hence probably what's happening in Toronto right now.
Right? Yeah, it's going to be interesting in the next couple of years, because there hasn't been there isn't going to be a lot of projects that, you know, get a shovel in the ground. The market's slow right now, so their budgeted amount that they think they were going to get from development charges is going to be much, much lower than what's actually going to come in.
So when you take everything into account between all the cities, the development charges and everything into account, is the profit roughly the same? Like, is that why you would stay? Or because the sale price is going to be higher in Toronto than some of those other cities that you mentioned as well?
Yeah, more or less the profit is the same. In the US, they have slightly, it's slightly different. But in terms of like Canada, yeah, you got the profit margin between 8% and 12%. If it's a much smaller city, you would expect a higher profit margin, but there's also like more, there's more risk when you get into those smaller
so that's tertiary cities. Sort of what keeps you there then, right? Like to put eight up or with 12 all that.
No way. 8% or 12%? That's between, all?
That's it. Yeah. Developers don't make that much money.
That makes no sense. For all the risk that you have to take in development, you get 8 or 10. That doesn't between even make
sense. 8 to 12% is the profit margin. So it's a high, let's say it's a $200 or $100 million project. The developer's making between 8 and 12 million usually. If it's a great deal, it's about 15 million.
Wow. I'm just totally blown away by that number. I mean, sometimes people think that, like, I think that the perception out there is very different from the reality, because I think that if you asked somebody out on the street, how much do you think the developer here makes? And they're probably thinking, oh, they're probably making 50% of the, you know, the money on each of these units they sell. And, you know, that's like the, like they're mega millionaires or billionaires because they're building this stuff. And is that the same everywhere? Like, is that profit margin the same whether we're in like Edmonton or in Texas, or is it different?
In the US, it's higher. The US is its own beast. It's different. It's a lot more. It's just, they play a different game over there. The profit margins are higher. That sometimes it's easier to get investment, harder to get loans without the proper backing or proper covenants over there. But the profit margins are generally higher in the US, which is why it makes it more attractive. There it's between 15 and 20%.
Right. Okay. Even so, 15 or 20%, that's, I mean, I guess when you're talking about scale and if you're building like 600 units, I can see where the, you know, and, but then your timeline has to be faster if it's going to be very profitable, or it has to be bigger. Otherwise you're just tying, or you have to do multiple projects, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Otherwise, like the machine just shuts down. Like you're not putting enough into it to continue to develop. Are we going to see, like, with all the projects, like the condo, the, so you're going to know a lot. What I've been seeing is that there hasn't been a lot of sales in the condo market in the last, I don't know, 12 months. And if you're not getting the sales, how do people get to develop? And if they aren't developing, are we creating a huge shortage of housing? And I guess these aren't even questions that we we talk, but I mean, like, just talking to you, like, I'm generally like concerned then.
Yeah, I mean, right now, a lot of investors, I think condo investors, got burned with all these interest rate hikes. So they're sitting on the sidelines. They're waiting to see what happens. There's a lot of new investors that came in that didn't know what they were doing, that bought these projects at high prices that they'll never be able to cash flow. And, you know, this happened in 2019, 2020, 2021, and spring of 2022, where things were just, I don't know if you remember, but things were just crazy. Projects come in, you sell out a project in a weekend.
Right.
Now all these projects are starting to, they're starting to complete, they're closing. And a lot of these people that, you know, didn't know what they're doing, they thought the prices for the condos is always going to go up. They can't close right now. They can't get the financing. They don't have the, you know, their condo may actually be worth $200,000-$300,000 less than what they bought it for. So they got to come up with that extra amount of money. So for the next 6 months, it's going to be, for the next 6 to 12 months, I think it's still going to be a bit rough for condos. You can see single family already, it's starting to pick up. Low rise is starting to pick up. I've seen some launches for low rise sites do well. But condos, I think it's going to take another 6 to 12 months before we start to see any kind of significant sales. It could be longer, could be shorter. But when you look at it, let's say you look at it like two years, like next year, late middle next year, 2026, 2027, there's going to be no completions because nothing was sold in 2022, 2023, and 2024. Like no projects really got off the ground. So there's going to be a big, usually Toronto finishes 25,000 units a year. 2026, we're going to finish, I think, like 5,000. 2027, I think it's even less. So there's going to be a big supply crunch. The rents.
What do you think is going to happen?
The rents are going to go crazy.
Ah, interesting.
So it's good if you're an apartment building owner, in my opinion.
Wow, that's what I'm hoping.
Yeah, like you quit.
I got 25, so. Anyways.
So you were mentioning that, Luke, that you have 4 projects on the go right now. Is that correct?
That's right.
So tell us a little bit about those.
Yeah, absolutely. So we got 4 projects. They're all in the east end of Toronto. So Leslieville area and Scarborough. One of them, so I'll start the one furthest east. So that's on the border of Pickering and it's on the border of Pickering, close to the University of Toronto Scarborough campus. Mm-hmm. That's that one is 611 units.
Wow.
It's a 13-story building, and we were gonna go to sales in the fall of this year. But we're changing strategy on that one right now. We got another one, 3291 Retreat Condos. That one's 380 units. We were going to go to sales in the spring of next year. We're also changing strategy on that one. Then we got Cliffside Condos, which is basically right across from our office, right? Also right beside, the project that we finished last year, that's 226 units. And we went for sales early this year on that project. And then we have one other project. It's a boutique luxury 6-story building, 55 units in Leslieville area, where it's kind of like a church conversion project, but we're demolishing half the church. The congregation that we partnered with and keeping that one half, we're renovating it for them. And behind it, we're putting a 6-story building. So it's going to be completely separate. And it's a great area right beside Riverdale Park. It's going to be high end.
Wow. That is so cool. Those all sound really interesting. You said 380?
380 is the second one. 200.
Yeah. So you're changing strategy.
Yeah.
So what does that mean?
What, like, what's making you do that?
Yeah. So it's we were briefly talked about it earlier, but where, you know, our analysis of where the market is, kind of what we see happening. And what we know is going to happen in a few years from now, we're taking 2 of those 4 projects and we're going to be converting them into rental buildings. There's some great CMHC programs out there. You know, you can get 50-year amortization, low equity requirements. And, you know, for one of the projects, we spoke with our partners about it already. Everyone's on board. And the other project, we need to find like another, industry partner, like a small pension fund or family office, to take it, to make it a rental building.
So does that changes it for like permanently? So you could never go back and decide to sell the units?
Yeah, that's right. Speaking with CMHC, they don't want it condo titled. The specific programs that we're after, they want it under one title. So we wouldn't be able to kind of condominiumize it and sell units, paying off a portion of the loans as we go along.
Are you looking at the, like, what components of this? I know the programs that you're talking about. So you're looking for 50-year amortization, but are you also like going to take advantage of some other points in the program in order to get a higher LTV, like affordability or anything like that? Or are you not looking at
those? Yeah, there's the AM, I think it's the AMLP. It used to be the old RCFI program.
Yeah.
So we are, because they changed the way they define affordability. A few years ago, the way CMHC defined affordability was more area specific. And, you know, certain areas, they have very low, very low rents because they have very low buildings in those areas, very old buildings that have very low rents. Now they're looking more at it as taking the average income that's in Toronto, and you have to provide units that are about 30% of that income. And so we have some great, you know, 320, 330 square foot studio units.
Yeah.
That will rent out for $1,500. Market is probably $1,800, $1,900.
Yep.
But those are affordable. We check that box.
I've heard that again and again because it doesn't matter the size of the unit, that it's the number of units and the correlation to the average income. And we have a project out in Napanee that we're looking at doing, and I'll have to connect back up with you again, but we have like a 20 unit building on a quarter of the land, and we have the ability to build like another 65 units, another 34 units, and another 24 units on that land. But the CMHC financing, because of the average income, makes that some of the units that we build are almost like market rent. So it makes sense to participate in the program, right?
I you know, it used to be the CMHC programs, they were much more difficult before, but they've gotten a lot better, which is one thing I can say, like, good on the go.
And also this type of financing cannot be found in the US. That's the other piece that I think that not everybody understands, is that we have a very unique kind of financing model, although uncompetitive, but still unique, because we don't have the other insurers allowed to participate in the multifamily insurance market. Maybe we'd have even more unique products, but they just aren't allowed to. But it's really interesting to hear your potential there. So, I mean, we could go in a whole bunch of different ways on this, but what are some of the things that you look at when you're underwriting a potential development?
Mm-hmm. It varies. I mean, the number one thing that matters is what kind of rate that you can get, like what kind of rate that you can make on your money. We target 25% IRR on all our projects.
Yeah.
So you usually need a certain scale of project in order to be able to do that. And from what we found, this used to be about 100,000 square feet. Now we're not looking at any projects less than 170,000 square feet. So that's the first thing. So it needs to be have the scale. Official plan. We wanna do projects that are more or less in line with the official plan of the municipality.
Why is that? Just because of less bureaucracy?
Less bureaucracy. Even though it's going to take 3 years, at least the city's going to try to work with you because you more or less are within the official plan. There was one project that we did. We weren't in the official plan. It took us 6 years to get approvals.
Wow. But we want housing, right?
Apparently. Well, that's apparently. What
they say. So, was there any more?
Unlike the underwriting of a potential deal, yeah.
Yeah. Was there any other points in there?
Good areas. The other thing is like buying sites in an area that have some kind of unique USP, unique selling proposition, whether it's close to university, whether it's close to transit, whether it's close to like the beach. You don't want to buy something in the middle of the city that doesn't have anything unique about it. When like a downturn like this comes, it's going to be a lot more difficult to sell a project, to get people excited about it. There's no specific amenities in the area.
That makes a lot of sense. You know, otherwise it's just like every other project. And if there's 30 projects, what makes yours different, right?
Exactly.
And you must face so many different municipal challenges. Maybe you can give us an example of what those challenges kind of look like, because a lot of times all we're hearing from is, oh, the developers are doing this or the developers are doing that. And we're not really hearing the perspective of somebody who's actually doing the development and like all the different challenges that you face. I know there's NIMBYism, there's, those are the bananas who don't want anything anywhere. And, so those are, the public problem, but what are the municipal challenges that you have?
Municipal challenges there, it varies. There's one project we were doing, an affordable housing project in Scarborough. It's close to the GO train station. We wanted to build a 10-story building. It was zoned for seven stories. And the planning department and the councilor didn't want affordable housing, so they didn't want us to get the additional three stories. They're opposed against it. We ended up getting it approved, and then we just sold off the project because we knew that there's going to be just more issues with the planning department down the road. So that's one thing. The city says they want this, but the councilor is like, not in my area. I don't want affordable housing. I want it in general, but not in my area.
Yeah.
You could be fighting with the municipality on a retaining wall or a fence. I remember there's two submissions that we had to make, and the same comment came back both times. We don't want a wooden fence. We want a stainless steel, nice looking fence. So in the end, we're like, holy shit. Okay, really? Really? You really care about this fucking fence? So we gave them the fence. But it cost us 3 months because it took them that long to get back to us when we submitted.
Well, and they're not talking to each other. You mentioned that before, right? Like,
yeah. So it's just requirements, municipal, like they're guidelines, but they want you to build a certain number of 2 and 3 bedroom units. Some of the areas that we're building, they have a lot of single family homes. They have a lot of 2 bedrooms and 3 bedroom units already. They're lacking 1 bedroom and studios. So when you're fighting with municipality, you're showing them the data, this area doesn't need any more of these type of units. I'm like, no, we want it. So, you know, in the end, what happens is like the one bedroom and studios ended up subsidizing the two bedroom and three bedroom units because there, you know, there isn't a demand and people are willing to pay a lower price for it.
Okay. Wow.
So those are some of the items. Those are some of the issues.
Well, I'm going to ask you one last question to wrap up here. What do you think is the one key thing that could help incentivize development in Toronto? If there was one thing that could push it along, get it back where it needs to be, on the rails, instead of veering off.
We can make your wish come true. Bobblehead Rob can help you to do make your wishes come true.
Fees. We need to get rid of some of these fees. It's way too high. I'm myself and a few other developers, we started like a little coalition trying to tell the government, our provincial, our federal, our municipal government, that the fees are too high, we need to lower them. It would spur demand because the prices, they kind of overshot. And you have to remember, development is a margin business. If we don't make that 10 to 12% margin, we're not going to sell. We're not going to sell at a lower price because then we won't get financing. So the land prices can go down a little bit, but there's such a small portion of your overall budget. Usually it's about 3 to 5% of the budget is the land, whereas the fees are like 36%. So yeah. We need to, the construction prices, they have gone down a little bit, probably like 5 to 10% the past 12 months, but they're not going to go down much more. So it's really the only other thing that can help with help purchasers, help spur more development is fees at this point.
Wow. Is there something that people could do to help to get involved and
yes.
Bring awareness to this kind of thing?
Speak with your counselor, your MPs, send them emails. I think that's the only way. They need to hear it from a lot of people, not just a bunch of developers that are making millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars, right? Billions of dollars.
A billion, whatever the perception is.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Luke. I appreciate you sharing all this stuff. And we'll have you back just to hear how this how those buildings go when you convert them to rentals. I'd like to hear that process as well and see how that goes. Yeah, so
how do people connect with you and learn more about, you know, your projects and you?
Yeah. So you can connect with me. LCH.to is our website. So Lucas, LUKAS at LCH.to. You can email me. And also for like any new developers, people that don't know what they're doing, we also have our development management and construction management services. So we like to get in early. This way, we try to help you throughout the entire process. And it's just so you don't make the same mistakes that we've seen or that we've made personally, that could be costly.
Oh, that's okay. Awesome. I didn't even know you had that service. That's great, actually. I'm going to have to talk to you. That's good. Okay, great.
And we'll put the link to that LinkedIn article as well in the show notes. So if people want to see that, that's very interesting. It'll be in there in the show notes. And so thanks again, man. Really appreciate this.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. Quentin,
how can people get in touch with you?
Oh, you can go to quintindesouza.com. Catch me on Instagram. You can see my travels. That's where I usually post them, on Instagram at QmanREI. Or you can come out to a Durham REI meeting at durhamrei.com. And how about you, Rob? Awesome. How do people get in touch with you?
I think the most important thing that they should do, especially if they're planning any kind of trip to this area, is go to Manta Ray Lodge CR on Facebook, or Manta Ray Lodge on Facebook. I can't remember which one it is. Anyways, we're officially, unofficially open.
Yay.
I think we're still waiting on a few things, but we're accepting guests now. So go over there, look that up. And if you're going to be in the area, come and spend some time at our hotel. So
I want to do that this winter. I want to come visit you and then a friend of mine in Mexico. So gotta awesome. Do that. Yeah.
Yeah, that'll be great. Please do come down. And also just email me at rob@mrbreakthrough.ca. That's the best way. So thanks everybody for listening. And we will talk to you, see you, interact with you, learn from you, share with you next time.
All right. Take care.